Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another edition of the Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the publishing world. My guest today is author Matthew D. Hines. He has just published a wonderful treatise about life in Saudi Arabia, viewed through Western eyes. Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Simon. It's really nice to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Before we get into killing time in Saudi Arabia, which incidentally I do think is a most excellent work, I'm sure our audience are interested in learning a little bit about you. Who is Matthew Hines?
Oh, what a complex question to a complex character. Mr. Barrett, well, very briefly, not to bore your audience or anything, I am actually an educated teacher. I have a master's degree in secondary education, and most of my professional life I have been teaching, and before that, I served in the 82nd Airborne Division in the United States Army, and I grew up in a little town in Washington State called Squim, which is not a body fluid, which is something I have to clear up with people.
Okay, now, killing time in Saudi Arabia is dated as 2004. Was that your first adventure overseas, or were you teaching here in the U.S.?
Well, I actually was teaching here in the U.S. I'm actually trained as a high school teacher. I've taught everywhere from Anchorage and Wasilla, Alaska, to around the Seattle area in Washington State, and that was not my first experience in the Middle East. Killing Time in Saudi Arabia is actually the third book of a series of books that began in Oman in 2001. And I went there right after September 11th. So the series of books basically documents a person living in Arabia, teaching in Arabia with the Arabs, not hiding behind an embassy wall or hiding behind a compound wall, for the most part. But I'm actually living with people and living a day-to-day life. And it was actually a very pleasant experience, and that's why I wrote the first book.
All right. Enough of the interrogation. I will continue it later, though. Let's talk about killing time in Saudi Arabia. Normally at this point in an interview, I ask the author to outline the plot, but not give away any spoilers. I'm not sure if the spoiler warning is needed in this case, but I'll leave that up to you. Tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, I don't have to really worry about giving too much away because, as you've seen yourself, there are so many little subplots that happen throughout the course of the book that I could talk about one thing, but there's actually five or six things going on at any given time. I guess it's more of not the plot of the book, but the reason for writing the book, I think, would be more interesting for your readers. Because as you can see as you read the book, I'm working for a military contractor in the city of Riyadh. At the time, when they had just come out with the disclosure about Abu Ghraib prison, and the Iraq invasion had occurred. And so Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, basically just erupted. You had a lot of these terrorists that were infiltrating into the city from the outer regions. And within the city itself, there were these pockets of basically Bedouin tribes that live within the city, and they have their own little outposts within the town. Now, part of the book, and I don't feel like I'm giving anything away, I think this will interest the people that are listening, is that what I did, because the company I worked for, their methods were very questionable, and they didn't really seem to give a lot of credence as to whether people lived or died over there, and that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book for people that are thinking about going over and working on a military contract. You need to consider the reality, but in order to ensure my own survival, I went native, as they say, and I bought a Land Cruiser Jeep, which is what the Bedouin drove. I wore Saudi Arabian clothing, and as you see on the cover of my book, that's why that's there, because the cover of my book is what kept me alive. And there were a few guys that I worked with that were actually killed the time I was there. And in the time before I came there, and if you read the beginning of the book, I was recruited because the terrorists actually attacked this company. And so I had been recruited because a few of the teachers had been injured and had gone home.
Okay. I think that's a very good starting point. Now, I want to dig a little deeper, because that's the nasty kind of guy I am. It was a private military contractor that
yes.
you worked for, and you're up front at the beginning of the book about hiding names, so I won't even guess at the name, but you must have been fairly amazed at the mode of transport to get you to Saudi. 747?
Well, that's just a perfect example of the massive and unbelievable amount of wealth that the Saudi royal family has. I mean, if you can get four guys to ride over on an empty 747, and actually I think there may have been six passengers on the plane, but yeah, four guys to get over there, because we were four guys working for this military contractor, and the military contractor is responsible for the training of the Saudi National Guard, which supports the Saudi royal, well, not supports, but protects the Saudi royal family. So my job, in case your readers are interested, is I was recruited as an English teacher. And what I did was I taught the junior officers of the Saudi Arabian National Guard English. And then once they had sufficient skills in English, then they were sent to the United States to train. And I'll just say briefly that this is all part, and I do touch on it in the book, but it's all part of a very massive military contract. And there are a few books that have been written about it that can support what I have to say. Mine is more of a narrative, but the Global Arms Trade is a great book to look at, and Black Money, a PBS special on Frontline, is also a good supplement to this book. And then you can also see you can kind of figure out the names of these companies if you can look at those sources.
Well, we don't want to go there.
Well, no. Simon, I just want to say the reason that I don't disclose, because besides the fact that these people have an unlimited amount of access to legal, you know, things where they could come out and destroy my life if they wanted to, I also know guys still working at that company, and I don't want to risk their lives. I don't give any location information. I don't give any real names to anybody who's serving in a, you know, or was serving in a clandestine capacity. And can I also make just one mention here? I am not now, and nor have I ever been associated with the Central Intelligence Agency or any other intelligence agency for that matter. And one thing that I when I start talking and doing these interviews, and I don't know if you had planned on asking me that, is that it's always, well, what were you really doing there? And why were you really doing there? And from the first time I showed up in a little town in Oman in the middle of the night because they hadn't sent anybody to pick me up and I had to drive 200 miles through the desert to find the place where I was supposed to be, I was accused of being in the Central Intelligence Agency. And anybody who had read my book, Deceptions of the Ages, Mormons, Freemasons, and Extraterrestrials, would know my views on the Central Intelligence Agency and why I would have not have served there with them or been an asset for them or anything else. And also let me say that I do have friends in the State Department, and I have attended quite a few State Department functions, but at no time have I ever had any association with anybody in any clandestine capacity. So I don't. Okay. I really don't. I don't like people asking me that because it takes away from the argument and what I was really doing there. So,
right now, I just want to clear up one thing. The Saudi Arabia National Guard. This is
right.
Not like the National Guard here in the U.S. This is a very prime group. Would you like to explain exactly what they do? Well, not exactly, but their function.
Well, sure. Yeah, I talk about that in the book. I mean, I explain it pretty specifically. Their function is to protect the royal family. They have a number of branches of the military. They have a regular army that is under one of the princes. The National Guard, their sole mission is to protect the royal family. And that means the royal family is spread out throughout the world. I mean, they have villas in Paris and Los Angeles and Hollywood and London. So the National Guard is a intelligence group. They have tanks. They have anything a modern army would have. But unlike our National Guard, which is basically a supplement to our military, the National Guard there is, I want to use this term, I don't have another term for it, but it is like a welfare system. It keeps the Bedouin tribes, and for people who don't know about Saudi Arabia, don't take anything that I say unless you've actually looked into the history of the country, but the country is made up of Bedouin tribes, and to keep the loyalty of those tribes, a certain number of slots are given to those tribes for people to serve in the National Guard. They get officer slots, they get slots for regular soldiers, so that there's always a little bit of the dole coming out from the oil money to the tribes, and that keeps them loyal to the king.
Okay. Why did you wait 10 years to publish?
Life happens. I went from when I left Saudi Arabia, I went back to Oman and I started teaching again. And I produced my second book called Another Year in Oman in 2008. And this project has just been hanging in the back of my mind forever, but I've been so busy teaching and my focus is always teaching that I when I start to do this, I'll do a little. I worked on this project for 10 years, and it never got past the first 8 chapters. And then in my last job in Saudi Arabia, I left in 2013, I was working for Raytheon, and I said, I'm going to go home, I've got money now, I'm going to go home and finish this book, because I don't want to continue until I finish this project. So this is the third of 3 books, and that's why it took so long, because I was so focused on teaching and being a good teacher that I just didn't spend that much time on it.
Okay. I'm done with the Inquisition. Let's move on to slightly lighter issues.
I need to dry off from the waterboarding here, Mr. Right. Yeah. Grab a towel.
I love Killing Time in Saudi Arabia.
I appreciate you saying that.
I'm one of those nasty readers that reads between the lines, and there's this veneer of humor, but when you peel that away, there's a much different book. It's about the clash of cultures. West meets Middle East, and maybe just important in your case, West meets Western PMC, private military contractor culture. I'll stop right there and let you comment.
Well, I think I know what you're driving at here, and what you're trying to get at is that you have two cultures that are so adamantly opposed to each other. I will just answer by saying this: I worked with so many Saudis because the company I worked for, they employed a lot of Saudi Arabians as well as Saudi Arabian nationals, as well as Filipinos and Indians, and you know, but the company was mostly, you know, ex-military people. And I worked with so many Saudis the Saudis I worked with the most were the most wonderful, for the most part, kind, considerate people, you know, that I met in the Middle East, and they were, you know, Oman is famous for that. But the people I had the pleasure to work with were just fine, kind, gentle gentlemen and really considerate. And they all told me, I pray, or not everyone, but they say, I have to pray to Allah to forgive me for working with you people. So I think that's the answer to your question. And they are definitely they're schizophrenic. The people who are, you know, supporting this military machine because it's a job, and then that it goes against all their beliefs. So,
I'll take a different tactic in my waterboarding.
Let me get my snorkel out this time.
Right. I am snorkel. Joking. There's a particularly fine part of the book that I enjoyed greatly. You didn't seem to get along great with Garth Villa. And, well, if you read my review, you'll find out that I have a different name for the man, but that's got nothing to do with it. You were teaching Saudis English, and
right.
I just love the bit about, you know, describing car parts, which could not be done in the classroom. So, as I recall, you took them outside and pointed at things. Would you care to share that story?
Yeah, well, that was that's basically the tail end of a conflict that runs throughout the book between myself and my supervisor, and it was one of the final nails in the coffin as far as the relationship between him and myself, because I had done 1 year contract, I had extended, and I didn't want it just looked to me like it's just, you know, this is like a game, and they're going to try to get rid of me and keep all of the money that they owe me and all that kind of stuff. So from that point on, I had to, and I had done it a few times before, but I was really forced to go to the company I was working for their what do you say, their the company that owned them, and this is a multi, you know, these are both multi-billion-dollar multinational groups, but I had to go to this larger company, the parent company, just to make sure that I got out of there in one piece, and that I got out of there financially intact, because it just looked like, from the time that I got there, it just looked like they were really, I don't know, there's a continuing game, and that's part of the book, is just this continuing conflict that goes on between me and myself.
You're looking too deep. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about, you know, taking your students out of the classroom,
and being written up for it.
Right, but there's a story within a story. Not all of the students were as good at picking up English as others. So, you take them outside and you point to bits of a car, and, you know, the question is, what is this?
and the answers come from all the other students.
Right.
Well, you know, I don't talk about that too much. I talk a little bit about the psychology of teaching in Arab countries, a little bit in Killing Time. But my year in Oman, which was where I'm basically just thrown in front of a group of students with no prior, you know, warning or anything, and just basically fell on my face. It really took me a long time to understand the Arab psyche. And the one thing that teachers now and that any teacher who wants to teach in the Middle East has to understand is you're not teaching one person ever. You're teaching the whole class, and the whole class doesn't work as one student. And Westerners can't understand that, you know, and so what we call cheating, they don't really understand that concept. They just understand, I'm just helping my friend. There's nothing wrong with that. So it really drives people crazy, and it was one nice thing about working for that company and teaching at that school is that they were on what is called the Defense Language Institute curriculum, which is set out by the United States military. So all the testing and all that is taken out of the teacher's hands, and it's standardized, and so we didn't have to worry about, you know, it's the students bothering us about giving them answers to questions on tests or telling them what the exams were about, which was a big problem when I was in Oman.
I can understand that. But as a teacher, were you satisfied, you know, or grumpy?
As a teacher, I was happy to be teaching, and it's always been this way in my teaching career. I always love my students. There's a handful of students in 20 years of teaching that I've ever had a problem with, and the rest of them I have loved. It's always been the administrations I've had to work with, or a supervisor or something. And now in Oman, I had really good supervisors, and so there was no real conflict there. So that was the ideal situation. But working for a military contractor, you have people there that are not there for teaching; they're there for money, and so they have alternative or ulterior motives for what they do. And teaching, you know, we were teachers, but the the purpose of the whole unit was training soldiers, right? And there's a big difference between teaching students and training soldiers. And so they wanted us to be really hard on these students, and the harder you got on the students, the more you suffered. And then everything came back, including the company itself would come back on you. And so the best thing that I found to do was to just be good to the students, give in to them up to a certain point, and they would take care of you. And that's exactly what happened. As you see throughout the book, there are pictures of me with the Saudis in different settings, and because I was invited many times to people's homes, to weddings, and things like that, which was not normally done to anybody, but just me. So,
there's aspects of the book that I have to admit that when I read, I went, oh, that's unusual. It seems to me that the clash between West and East, or at least Eastern Moors, you kind of sorta met in the middle ground, and I'm not sure that your Western counterpoints or compatriots agreed with you, particularly not Garth Villa.
Okay. Well, do I just answer yes and then we continue on, or do you want me to elaborate?
Oh, I would love you to elaborate.
All right, then. Okay. I went to the Middle East because I had been there before when I was in the Army, and I loved it. I found it very interesting. When I was in Oman, I traveled to every place I went. If you look at a map of Oman, there's no place that I have not been. And I wanted to do the same thing in Saudi Arabia. I was almost finished with working on my first Oman book, and I really saw so much in Saudi Arabia, and with the terrorism and all that, I saw, well, this is going to be very, or this could be very interesting. But that required, I needed access to get outside, to be outside of the compound. And let me just explain something to you. Why don't more Americans or people write books about the Middle East? Because, you know, there's been millions over there, or at least a million, since the war on terror. You know why they don't? Because they don't go anywhere. They sit in their house, they watch TV, and when their time is up, they get on a plane and they go away. I didn't do that, and I said I would never do that, and that was why I got so much respect from the Arabs, because I was out there living with them, I was doing what they do, and you know, and let me also say, I'm not Muslim. I'm a Christian. I grew up a Latter-day Saint or a Mormon, and they have no problem with that. They were fine to that I was a Christian, and although they tried to recruit me, they didn't really have any problem with it because they just thought I was a nice person that liked Saudi Arabia. So what created the conflict was when I wanted to go out and I wanted to experience the country, and my contract said that I would have access to vehicles. Everybody else on the contract had access to a reasonably good piece of transportation. But as an English teacher, we were given the worst of everything. And we were forced to ride around in cars that were basically death traps. And had we ever been attacked or anything, there would have been not one or two people killed. But in one car, they were putting five people packed in. So the conflict between my supervisor and myself that you talk about, and that kind of, you know, comes to a head when I try to show the students about the car, that is just because he wanted me to come there and sit in my villa, do my work, and not go anywhere or ask her for anything, because all of the good things that we were given, he had taken. So I was just a threat to him. And one of the subplots of the book is that I was in the military, and his supervisor, we trained in the same places in Fort Bragg. So I could just go over my supervisor's head at any time, and more often than not, I needed to do that.
It is so sad, and the question in my mind is the why. Why would Garth Villa? I still have trouble.
Can I reiterate not his real name?
Yes, indeed.
And if you're out there listening, ha ha.
Now, I think I did unravel part of the clue, but again, my definition is not a real name. But did you really base him on Darth Vader?
Well, there is a line in the book that I was very proud of when I came up with it, and it went something like, he was your quintessential workplace villain. Something like, Viller was your quintessential workplace villain. I was very proud of that line. You can take away from it what you want. You know, the part of literature, or the nice thing about literature is you're free to conjure up whatever images you want. And if you want to talk about a guy in a black cape and a black helmet with an asthma problem walking around and write me up, then you go ahead and do that.
I don't want to push that subject, but let's move on. What sort of feedback are you getting from readers?
A lot of them are the same as yours. Just, why did you do that? And I can't believe you're not dead. You know, basically the same thing. Most people just focus on the humor and oh, funny book. But why did you do that? You know, and people who have read my Oman books, they understand the appeal of Oman, but why did you go to Saudi Arabia? So basically that's it. And then of course it's the, well, what were you really doing there? So
oh, I love it.
You know, can I just tell you a little anecdote?
Sure.
A girl I grew up with in the little town of Squim, Washington, her dad was a ranger in the army and in Korea, and he was always proud of me that I'd gone into the 82nd Airborne. And my wife and I went to visit him and his wife, and we sat down, and, you know, he's an older gentleman, and the first thing he says is, okay, Matt, tell me what you're really doing over there. And I was like, no, I'm just teaching English. So anyway, besides what were you really doing there, then people do appreciate the humor. And with all of my books, Simon, I think that because I was born with a sense of humor, I'm able to teach things, and this is kind of my appeal in the classroom as well. I can make things funny so that things that might seem like they would not be interesting, they actually end up being very interesting. And I got a review on my Deceptions of the Ages book, and I got a D. I took high school physics. I don't know why I did, but I got a D, and some woman sent me a thing and said, I never understood physics until I read your book. And so if I can make something as dry and uninteresting as physics be interesting, then I guess I can do the same thing for just about anything.
Okay, where can people buy copies of Killing Time?
Well, first of all, you can buy them from me. You can just go on, you can go to www.hindsight.com. I don't know if you're going to post a link on your thing or not, but you can buy paperback copies from myself, or they're available on Amazon. They're available in Kindle format. And also, can I also say that on Thanksgiving of next week. On Thanksgiving, there will be a free download available for Another Year in Oman, my second book. So if anybody has a Kindle, they can just go on Amazon and get that. And anytime that you buy a paperback book from Amazon, from me, or one of my books on Amazon, they will give you a free matchbook on your Kindle. But I'm also on iBooks, Kobo, Barnes and Noble, and whatever other bookstores. I'm bad. I'm nationwide. I'm worldwide, as ZZ Top might say.
Okay. I'm going to lighten it up a little bit. Would you recommend teaching as a career for people heading out to the Middle East?
Would I recommend it? If you are a person who likes to experience cultures that are different, absolutely. But if you're just going to go over there, and there's a line in Apocalypse Now, the movie, where they say that, yeah, these guys came over and they just wanted to make everything like home, and the more they made it like home, the more they missed it. And so if you're going to do that, don't go. The first thing I did when I went to Oman is I looked around and I said, I've got to explore this place. I got to see what's out there. I bought a car and I went out and I did everything and anything that I could do. Diving, snorkeling, exploring, camping. So if you're into that kind of stuff, then I recommend it. But if you're just there to make money or whatever, you're not only hurting yourself, you're also hurting, you know, people's images of Westerners. And they have such a bad stereotype of Westerners there that people will just come up or that are just coming for money and they don't care about their culture. If that's how you are, don't do it. And I'll also say this: teaching in the Middle East opened it improved. I mean, the students there are so different. It honed me. It made me such an excellent teacher. And I was able to perfect so many skills like computer and multimedia and so many things. And I was able to do that because I was able to teach with students that were not, you know, that were not the normal students. So if you're a peer teacher, yeah, do it. If you like other cultures and you want to experience a different thing in life, do it. But if you just want to, you know, go eat a McDonald's burger every time you go out, then stay home. Don't go.
How difficult? Obviously, you had spent time in Oman, but you know you arrive in Saudi Arabia. How difficult was it to acclimate to the culture?
It wasn't difficult at all because I had gone from being surrounded by Omanis to being surrounded by Americans. So I actually was just basically stepping back in to the American culture. And for people who are interested in teaching in Saudi Arabia or the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, unlike the other countries that are there, and I can't speak for everyone individually, but Saudi Arabia, you will probably live on a secure compound, whereas Oman, Dubai, the Emirates, and Qatar, generally they just put you in apartments or your own villas. So you're living out with the people. But when you're in Saudi Arabia, they do everything they can to take care of you. So that's one of the pluses is that you have no phone bill. Well, you have a phone bill, you just pay for your phone. No electricity, no rent, no nothing. Gas is like 60 cents a gallon. They provide you with cars for the most part, except for the company I worked with. So it's a great way. And so basically, you keep all the money you make, and that's the advantage of living there. But if you're, you know, as I said again, life is more than money. And if you're just going to go there and sit in your hole and collect your money, you know, you're not going to have a very good time, and you're gonna end up leaving and do what most people do, and that's saying a bunch of horrible things about the country. So,
One of the things that comes across in Killing Time in Saudi Arabia was your need. I'd call it a thirst, but I don't mean that in the liquor sense. Just for human companionship. You joined the local, or one of the local chapters of the Hash House Harriers. No one has ever heard of them except me. But there again, I'm really old.
I know. Are you talking about in the UK or the US?
The first time I found out about them was in the US, San Diego. Mm-hmm. We employed someone from South Africa, and he asked me if there was any local Hash House Harriers.
You go, what?
Yeah, that was pretty much my response.
I was like, they have a house for that? Isn't that up in Seattle or something?
No, he was just looking for a Hash House Harriers group he could join.
Yeah, but you mentioned that name here, and nobody thinks of exercising.
Right. Now,
everybody thinks of Seattle and Nirvana.
Right. Would you care to explain what the Hash House Harriers is all about?
Well, I can, and I'll do the best that I can, but I am not an expert on it, as I say in my book, but... how it relates to the story is that was the social group in Saudi Arabia, or in Riyadh. And so what you had, and I talk about this as a social phenomenon in the book, and I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but an interesting thing about Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, is you have thousands of single or variable status women that are working as nurses, secretaries, engineers, accountants, whatever. And you have all of these, variable status men that are working there on contracts where their wives are not allowed. So what do you think happens? You know, so the hashing was just an avenue for it to meet women. And where was the hashing held? It was done out in the middle of the desert. And So people who read the book are going to go, well, you know, if these people are out in by the dozens in the middle of the desert in Saudi Arabia, isn't that kind of dangerous? And the fact is, nobody. I mean, precautions were taken, but for the most part, it was overlooked because that drive, that need to meet other people, and that need to get out of this existence that I live in. Just outweighed all that. And another thing is that we were working with South Africans, or we were socializing, and my girlfriend was from South Africa. And when they looked at us Americans and how we hide on our compounds, and they say, are you kidding me? You think Riyadh is dangerous? Try Johannesburg sometime. You know, and they would laugh at us because Americans would be all hiding on their compounds and saying how dangerous it was. And, you know, but there was a small group of us that went out and we did the hashing and things like that. And I just want to also mention, if you look in my not the print editions but the Kindle books and the iBooks, especially the iBook, those have a lot of pictures. And in the iBooks, they have widgets with maps, pictures, and so that I really cover a lot, and you can get a really good picture of what life is like in Riyadh if you can get a hold of the iBook version of it.
Okay. Let me see if I can wrap my head around the concept of hashing. In its traditional form, it's a bunch of guys that get fairly drunk, and a couple of them head off first, laying down a trail. In fact, it's based on an old game called Fox and Hounds, I think it is. And after a couple of hours, the hashers head off to find the end result. Do I have that fairly correct?
Yeah, except that, and I apologize for trying to throw at you the mega mob version of the hash house. And I don't really understand the term hash house carriers that well, but the mega mob did not. Okay, it was basically based on the Malaysian the British Army in Malaysia invented it, and it was made so these guys would run around the jungle, and they would make trails. And they would make false trails, and then you had to find the real trail, and whoever got the real trail. Well, and this is all done while you're running. Now, in the desert with our group, you know, a lot of us are close to middle age, or we're close to middle age, not going to do any running. And we were just there to meet women. So, and the women were just there to meet men. So everybody went through the motions of going out. We would set the trails out. But the thing was just to find somebody to kind of pair up with and to check out, you know, what was out there. And so that was the middle of the desert was basically our social scene. And let me just finish. We had in our group, we had a guy called Smurf. And I don't know if he's still there, but he was a funny man, and I describe him in great detail in the book. But he was what you would call a martinet. He was very strict about the hashing. Things had to be done according to the rules, and if people didn't do things as he wanted them, then he was like a Napoleon, and he really went off. And also, let me say that alcohol is not allowed in Saudi Arabia. So, where the hashing focuses on alcohol, water was used. And I do mention in the book that, although I personally cannot say that I recall having ever seen or had any, there was fermented wine available. And I also talk about there were other forms of alcohol that were available on the black market that people did have access to, but I didn't, or at least that I can remember.
Oh, I think
what
you are
Clinton
telling
say?
The truth.
Yes, I didn't inhale. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right. Okay, we're just about out of time, but I do have one last question. Once you get the writing bug, no vaccine can stop it. So what's going to be your next project?
I would actually like to do, I have a ton of pictures that I would like to just do a book, a picture book about called My Year in Oman in Pictures, which would basically cover the first and second books. And beyond that, I've never, and let me just explain to your readers, I went into, when I was in high school, I used to write for the high school newspaper, and everybody thought I would be a famous writer. When I grew up, I said, I'm not going to be a writer. I'm going to use my talents as a teacher, and, you know, I'm fairly smart, I guess. And so I will use my talents, and I will make the world a better place by teaching. And I've reached that point in my life where, you know, I've done some writing, But now I really want to leave teaching behind, and I want to write. So my next projects, actually, I'd like to do a children's book about the dangers of television. As funny as that might be.
Oh, I love the concept,
it's called the Magic Glass.
As it happens, I love children's books.
Okay. Well, I need an illustrator, but it's called the Magic Glass. I'm not saying that I am going to write it, but I would if I can make enough money from writing and my wife and I can be comfortable, then yeah, I would. I have so many books that I would like to write. I love history, and if you read my Deceptions book, you'll see that I basically covered a lot of areas that are really left open to much more research. And so I would like to research some more of the topics. One of those being what did the Knights of the Temple find during the Crusades? What did they find at the mosque? You know, and so.
Aha! Those are great questions.
Yeah, and Simon, you will be getting those books. You'll be getting that book and my other book soon enough. So you'll be able to see them, and we can talk about them later.
Okay. I do have to call an end. Matthew, it has been delightful to talk to you. And I am sure that we will be talking again soon. Do you have any parting words?
Well, no, I'd just like to say thanks a lot for your time, Simon, and thanks a lot for your effort and looking over my book, and your review was fantastic. And, you know, when you write, you just go, oh, my gosh, are people going to get this? And you got it. You got it. So that I've been so worried. People are just going to think I'm just crazy. But you got it. So I appreciate that. And I'm here anytime you need somebody to talk to.
Okay. This is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week. And we will be back again with another edition of the Week in Review soon. Until then, goodbye.
Is that it?